Hey, welcome back to the Mining Pod. On today's show, we are joined by Bitcoin Core developer Peter Todd. We recorded this conversation down at Bitcoin Plus last week in Austin, Texas, along with my co-host Charlie Spears. We basically went through mining pool centralization and should Bitcoin miners be concerned that a lot of the hash rate is now flowing to Ant Pool and Foundry, mostly Ant Pool, by looking at a lot of these different disbursements to Bitcoin miners and Bitcoin mining holding addresses. So we went through that with Peter Todd. Thank you to him for joining the show. And thank you to Bitcoin Plus for opening up the venue for us to record. We have a little more content from Bitcoin Plus coming up as well, including some stuff that's already live on our Twitter account. Okay, before we get into the show, we want to thank our sponsors, CleanSpark, America's Bitcoin Miner, and Forman Mining, Master Your Mining. Thank you to both these sponsors for making the show possible. And you'll hear more from them in a little bit. Okay, before we get into the show, we also want to push the Blockspace Podcast Network, where we have two other podcasts that are growing pretty quickly. The Beat the Gort Show, which is conversations with crypto's brightest lights on all things Bitcoin. So we're going through first principles about, you know, do we need another blockchain? Why does this AMM work, or how does this marketplace work? And then Bitcoin Season 2 with my co-host on the Mining Pod, Charlie Spears, where he talks with all the new actors and faces within Bitcoin Season 2. From layer twos to opcodes to ordinals and more. So if you're into more of the technical discussions, definitely go check out Bitcoin Season 2. You can find all this content and more on blockspace.media. Okay, thank you for listening to the show. Let's jump into it. Hey, listeners, let's talk about revolutionizing your mining operation with Forman. This isn't your average management tool. It's an all-in-one solution for reducing costs and significantly boosting your revenue. Forman brings a cutting-edge dashboard to your fingertips, empowering you with automated energy strategies. This means not only curtailing around real-time prices, but also strategically enhancing your profit margins through demand response. It's about leveraging energy efficiency to its fullest potential. With Forman, you get a system that scales with your business. Inventory management for assets, infrastructure integration, and business intelligence. Forman elevates the cash flow and production of your entire operation. To see how Forman can redefine your mining operation standards, visit forman.mn. With Forman, you're not just managing a mining operation, you're setting a new standard in the industry.
Are you a retail or institutional investor interested in Bitcoin mining companies? The Miner Mag brings you free data and analysis from all major NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin mining operations to know who stands out. Check out visualized metrics and data-dependent stories at theminermag.com.
Carlinho, and he led a team to do that election fraud thing down
in... Yeah, he led a team to do the election fraud?
Yeah, exactly. That was what I... Well, actually, I didn't get the full story, but I'll probably interview him on...
We kind of laugh about it, but the story there, you can almost twist it to say open timestamps did election fraud.
Yeah.
Because what actually happened there was the ruling government that got kicked out of power. I mean, you know, and I could be getting this somewhat wrong, but I'll give you the simple version of it. The ruling government that got kicked out of power did deliberate election fraud and then tried to go prove it to get the entire election thrown out. So had they succeeded, yes.
What?
Yes. Yes. So, like, you know, they were losing, right? And they wanted to get another chance at a new election.
They said, no, see, look, we were fraudulent with the last election.
Well, the idea there is, well, it isn't necessarily us that committed election fraud. The election has to be thrown out. And had they succeeded in doing more of it, rather than just a one small area, it would have been open timestamps helping prove to the world, yeah, there's probably election fraud going on here. We really should redo the election like the ruling party conveniently wants. But in this case, it was opposite because we could actually prove, other than that one area, there wasn't election fraud.
That's what Carlinho said. He was like, well, it got really political. And he was like, I have to hand wave here a bit. But yeah. Maybe that's what he was referring to, is that that's where it gets really...
Yeah, it's a complex story.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it may not necessarily make people happy.
So did you play much of a role in helping him design and talk through how to do this?
Zero. They came to me like the last minute saying, hey, we're going to do this thing. We want to go look at the design and like tell us it's okay. And maybe, you know, make sure the servers stay up and, you know, do one or two other small modifications. Like, compared to the work they did, I had a very small role.
And now, so is this one of, I mean, there's many people who've used open timestamps for a lot of things. You know, you look at this playing a major role in the Guatemalan elections. What's your kind of reflection on this being used at the scale?
Well, I do have to push back a bit because I always want to point out, I mean, open timestamps was just one of many things, you know, proving the validity of those elections. Like it's, you know, list, like it's on a list, and if it's on the list, it's probably like number item number 50, right? Now, item number 50 is still important, but, you know, it's not like it was the only, it was the thing that saved Guatemalan elections. It was a lot of stuff that saved it. But certainly in terms of impact, it's still one of the more interesting things that has ever happened with open timestamps. You know, and it was quite interesting actually being there in person at the, you know, elections headquarters.
Oh, so you went down?
Yeah, I was there in person. In fact, I was an official government contractor with a badge. Yeah, I was registered in their system and everything. It was great. And, you know, and then of course I got access to the backstage stuff that Carlino actually couldn't. But yeah, you know, at the beginning of it, like they have this kind of ceremony where they reset the database for the polling results.
Yeah.
You know, and it, to be clear, it's interim polling results. There's like two separate systems here, but the ones that get results quickly, it's computerized. They go reset the database and sign their little form saying we've all done it, we've all witnessed it. And then they scanned it in and timestamped it. And like they didn't tell us they were going to do that. And right in front of live TV, and you know, with all the major politicians there, they're time stamping something, and then of course they're waiting for confirmation.
Oh,
and I think somehow someone kind of clued them in. It's like, you know, it might take a while. You might want to move on to the next step of the ceremony. Like, no one's interested in watching you wait there for 10 minutes.
Commercial break.
Yeah.
Well, the irony being that if there's, you know, hundreds of people there, government officials, and it's streamed on television. Of all things you need timestamp, that's probably the lowest on the totem pole.
Like I say, this is why in general, it's like item number 50.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many eyes on this stuff in so many different ways, but you add them all up and together they make for something secure.
Yeah.
And so, you know, every part's important. It's just individually, they're not that important.
It is kind of, it's funny because I thought, because Carlini was saying, well, it's like 25,000 polling booths and they've got to scan all these documents. But I guess, you know, and my immediate thought was, oh man, that's a lot of JPEGs to put on Bitcoin. But no, you hash it, you produce a tree.
It's a magic of Merkle trees.
Merkle trees.
In fact, so another thing I did a few years back was I quote unquote timestamped the internet. Now, of course, what I really mean is
what does that mean?
Well, I downloaded the metadata for Internet Archive.
Okay.
Put that all together and then timestamped all of that. But in total, that was like a bit over like 500 million individual hashes that were all assembled into one giant Merkle tree. And then just for kind of shits and grins, we then used a single individual Bitcoin transaction to actually timestamp all this. But certainly, you know, had I written the software slightly differently, I could have easily just put it into the normal open timestamps queue and it would have ended up in a Merkle tree and just like everything else. Like,
when
Merkle trees solve everything. 2017, I think. So open timestamps in the current iteration is 2016. And then I actually started the project in like 2012.
I didn't know it was that old.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a functional open timestamps running in like 2012, 2013.
Okay.
Probably 2013, I think.
Okay, I didn't know it was that old. Before we get too deep into it, let's do the quick classic bio. So welcome back to the Mining Pod. We're at Bitcoin Plus Plus in Austin, Texas. We're joined today by Bitcoin Core contributor Peter Todd, also of Open Timestamps, but I'll let you do your full bio, and then we're going to talk about Bitcoin mining centralization, Matt Corello's article the other day, and Mevel, MEV, your take on it.
Mevel.
Yeah.
Mevel. Such a cute name.
It is kind of cute.
Well, I want some Mevel.
Why did he name something so insidious so cute?
Did he? He didn't name it, but...
Well, he tried to go change MEV to something like...
Cute.
That wasn't so unclear, but then he accidentally made it cute.
That's classic market.
Like, MEVX.
You know, the greatest travesty...
murder.
The greatest travesty is that we have yet another acronym that we have to remember and argue over actually what it means. Yeah. So.
Yeah, but I'll give it to you for the bio since this is a Bitcoin mining podcast and miners don't know anything about Bitcoin tech. It's still true.
Yeah, so I'm Peter Todd. I've worked on Bitcoin Core enough that Craig Wright sued me.
That's the greatest bio ever.
It's a low bar. And, you know, for miners at least, lately I've been working on something called Libra Relay, which relays more transactions than Bitcoin Core. Not a lot more, because Bitcoin Core actually relays a fair bit. But, you know, I've done a bit of work on, like, basically telling Bitcoin Core, like, you can't do Luke Jr. stuff. It's not going to work. And
some nod shots. Let's go.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get into Ocean a little bit later. Nuts.
Yeah. And the other part of that is like, we're also working on something called Replace by Fee Rate, which tries to solve transaction pinning.
I wanted to get into RBF, but I feel like that might be.
Well, I won the full RBF argument, so.
You did win it. Yeah. I followed along all last year. It was great. I do think it might be a little much for this show. Yeah.
The only way I haven't won it is that Bitcoin Core hasn't enabled it by default.
True.
But if like 99%+ of miners enable it, I've won it.
Yeah. No. It's, what was the last group that just did it? Foundry just did it the other day? Not too long ago.
It all happened really
fast. Foundry was not last. I think they were second last.
Yeah.
I think it was like via BTC maybe.
Okay. Because there was a lot recently with Ordinal stuff, right? Where they like did it for fee sniping.
Well, I mean, basically currently, if you don't run full RBF, you lose thousands of dollars per block. Yeah. Like you'd be crazy not to.
And a few of them learned that lesson the hard way. Yeah. So, okay. Let's talk about Matt Carlo's piece. So we covered on the news roundup. And for listeners, you go back to that or listen to the next 30 seconds. Essentially, Matt Carlo went on Marty Bent's podcast, also here in Austin, Texas, and they talked about the current landscape for Bitcoin mining pools, how all these Bitcoin miners seem to be using Ampool's block template.
Yeah.
Matt Carlo is not super happy about this. He's calling for Stratum B2 to be implemented by all these Bitcoin miners, and he lowered his very bullish take on Bitcoin mining, saying not 5% anymore, but it's going to be less than 5% chance of Bitcoin succeeding. So he's calling for like action very quickly. And that's why we want to talk to you about it.
Well, you know, you should give me homework because I don't think I've actually read that piece.
That's okay. Your spicy takes are more informed than most people.
That's a pretty good idea of what he was saying anyway. So, but first of all, I'm not clear that thing with Antpool is actually correct because I was following full RBF adoption very closely and it did happen in stages. It was like one pool does it. Then clearly no other pool, like, you know, no, it's not, you know, two pools doing it at once. And then, you know, yet another pool does and so on. However, what that could have happened is maybe they all just adopted like Antpool's templates.
Yeah.
Right. Like I don't actually know.
What do you, what would that look like on the back end? Like assuming if we imagine that a significant amount of different pools were using the same block template producer, what is, assuming we're talking to like a guy who plugs in ASICs all day.
Well, assuming we're talking to that guy, from his point of view, not much changes directly. I mean, we don't even notice because he's not running Stratum V2. But I mean, the thing with it is, interesting question is, let's assume for sake of argument that this has actually happened. Why are mining pools doing this? Like, what's the actual advantage? And there's a lot of scenarios. I mean, one could be, you know, maybe some spook is just paying them to do this. It's like, you know, we'll pay another 1% on top of your reward if only you do this thing for reasons we're not going to tell you. But yeah, it's not really clear. And miners, you know, so far I haven't seen any clear statements by mining pools that they're not doing this, like, or that they are. Like, it seems kind of something where people aren't talking about it much. So it's kind of hard to know, you know, and the tech wise, like the way this could happen is something as simple as they just have a, you know, a URL somewhere and just redirect it with like some query path to say, hey, you know, the hash is actually coming from here, not here. Make sure the payouts go to the right place. Of course, it gets to the custody thing of, well, seems a lot of people are using the same custodian for these payouts.
Yeah.
And it's not clear what that means or why.
Yeah, so for listeners also, we did talk about this as well. So I think it was 0xb1 something.
0xb10c.
Wow, very good memorization of a Twitter handle. He backtracked a lot of the payouts for pools and found that there's one entity behind a lot of them, entity called Kobo, the co-founder of Kobo.
To be clear, one entity behind where the payouts are going.
The payouts.
It's not the same thing as saying there's one entity behind the pools.
Yes, definitely. So the flows are going to one entity, Kobo, as either a custodian or exchange. It's unclear like where the money are,
what
that.
Is.
Yeah, where they're liquidating, if they're liquidating. But the co-founder of that has a relationship with Antpool. So there's also that there. What do you take on like the current landscape for pool centralization though? Like, because Matt was very clear, and I don't know if it was like a scare tactic thing, being like, hey, like we really want to get miners' attention, or if it is like really that bad. A lot of the miners I talked to were like,
I think a lot of it is it's hard to know what's going on there and what that means. And, you know, like I can give a hypothetical. I mean, let's imagine that this is actually all Antpool. Well, what happens if they do something bad with this? You really then give miners, you know, I really will say hasher is a choice. Do you want to continue pointing your hash rate at Antpool or do you point it somewhere else? And we do have other places to point it to that are probably independent. I mean, I highly doubt Ocean's part of this. But, you know, that could be an ugly process and that could involve people losing a bunch of money initially or getting delayed payouts for a while. I mean, you know, one explanation for why all this is happening could easily be something as boring as, yeah, there's one service that Antpool started using and it was really good at turning incoming Bitcoin into cash, which miners need. And who knows, maybe that's really all there is to it. Like a bunch of other people thought, well, we'll use them too. It's hard to know.
In the competitive world of Bitcoin mining, one name stands out, CleanSpark, America's Bitcoin miner. At CleanSpark, efficiency isn't just a goal, it's our standard. Our sophisticated facilities are built and led by expert teams who care about Bitcoin and the communities we work in. Scale, we've mastered it. Our large-scale operations have set us apart in the industry as examples of community-oriented building. Our track record speaks for itself. We navigate the complexities of the new economy with precision and with skill, continuously achieving operational milestones. Curious about how we do it? We invite you to discover the story behind CleanSpark's success at cleanspark.com.
So you point to Stratum V2, point to a pool like Ocean. Does Stratum V2 solve this and how, or what does it not solve?
Well, I mean, the thing that solves this the best has always been miners being able to point their hash rate at other pools and still make money. Like if something goes wrong, I mean, one of the issues with this is it's hard, you know, it's like, well, Stratum V2 as an example. Stratum V2 doesn't necessarily prevent censorship, because their hash rate can be rejected. And I think that's actually a hard requirement, because with Stratum V2, you could be submitting a block template that's stupid. And for instance, rejecting a bunch of inscriptions are going to make everyone money. Like it or not, that's a valid reason to go and reject a block template. The more important thing is, can miners switch their hash rate somewhere else and still stay in business? And unfortunately, things like Ocean aren't so great for that, because Ocean has weird ideological stuff that doesn't make them as much money.
Can you expound on that just for an aside?
At least we're talking to a person who racks ASICs.
Yeah.
Well, Ocean is not mining all the transactions that are paying fees for ideological reasons, because they don't like JPEGs in the blockchain.
It's a good reason.
Well, you know, it's a reason that's going to make you less money. So, like it or not, you're going to earn more money in the long run, all things being equal, by going to a pool that does mine those transactions. For much the same reason as now that full RBF has non-negligible fee difference, you'd be crazy not to turn it on. And in this case, basically all the pools turn it on. One of the exceptions would actually be the small percentage of hash power going to Ocean with the Bitcoin Core template, which isn't turned off because Bitcoin Core isn't turned off by default.
What do you think, and I'm going to stay in the Ocean thing for a second, and maybe we'll go back to Matt Corral's piece, but what do you think about Bitcoin Core contributors having jobs in the industry where they're revenue incentivized or money incentivized, as opposed to being like independent, unpaid, etc.?
Well, unpaid is out of it because we like eating.
People do like to eat.
I mean, I think it's fair to say I don't get paid for any Bitcoin Core contributions right now, which is why if you look at the Git repo, I haven't made any for years. Now, gotcha. You could argue I'm contributing in ways such as like replaced by fee rate.
Yeah.
But that's not merge code that's actually in Bitcoin Core. That's more like Bitcoin contribution.
Okay. Yeah. The thing I'm hinting at there is like Luke Dasher is now CTO of a mining pool.
Ironically, a mining pool that's not maximizing income.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you certainly need people with that kind of experience. You know, it would be very weird if no Bitcoin Core contributor actually ran any miners. Like, currently, like getting into true mining where you create your own block templates, it's not obvious how to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't currently have any Bitcoin hashers. I should, though, just to be able to say, like, I've actually looked at this whole thing.
Yeah, we can help you out.
Well, I mean, if you got something that'll it'll consume about 1,000 watts and go plug it into a normal outlet, because I don't have any good place to plug this stuff in, which is why I'm not running it right now. Like, I used to have Butterfly Lab stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, back in the day, Butterfly Labs would use, like, say, 400, 500 watts. So you could easily run it off an outlet without, like, annoying your landlord.
We have Future Bits now. They're kind of fun. Have you seen, you've seen Future Bits, I'm assuming. John Stephanopoulos.
Yeah, I think I've heard of this, yeah.
Yeah, it's like you plug and play device, sits on your desktop, or it sits on your desk, and you plug it in and you solo mine a block, is the idea. Probably won't ever make money, but if you mine a solo block, that'd be pretty sick.
Lottery mining.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a shame that, like, not many of us are, say, mining on testnet.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
like, I should at least have done that in the past
couple
years.
Testnet, yeah, like, yeah, there are some. Right.
Yeah. LOP is... LOP is
what are your thoughts on that? I'm curious.
Well, I mean, you know, the bigger picture there is this idea that you'll somehow make testnet useless for anything other than testing. I don't think the proposals floating around Bitcoin Core are anywhere close to doing that. I mean, for one thing, they're still hanging on to this idea that you can keep the same coin issuance schedule as Bitcoin, and somehow it will still be worthless. Like it or not, people will find excuses, even if you claim you're going to reset it. Because if you reset it, like every time you do that, it's a huge pain in the ass. I mean, I personally run a testnet DNS seed, and I don't know, I'm going to bother turning into testnet 4 or something. Like, screw that. Like, there's more important things to worry about. I think they would be much better off just taking testnet as it is and hard forking it to just remove the coin issuance to... at least make that not a problem. But you still have the issue that testnet block space is potentially valuable. In a testnet 4 block space, some scammer is probably still going to use it for something.
I mean, that was one of the points. Because I did kind of stumble my way through some of the Bitcoin mailing list discussion on this, of saying, well, like, we could just reset testnet to V4, but what does that solve? That just...
yeah, it'll probably
back
happen
to zero
all over
and
again.
It doesn't solve the incentive.
And also, because you've done this... you've kind of given marketing to certain types of these scammy projects. I mean, much the same way as, let's say, like, you know, the reaction we got to Ordinals inscriptions, that gave them all the marketing they needed. If Bitcoiners had done nothing other than just shut the fuck up and not interact with them, I don't think Ordinals inscriptions would be the thing it is.
Do you, I mean, you know, you are timestamping things. You're posting data to Bitcoin.
Not quite. Open timestamps, yes, technically the open timestamps calendars put some data in the Bitcoin chain, but, you know, there's like 4 of them and each of them only has to put 32 bytes in one op return, no matter how much it's used. So the amount is minimal. The other thing too is, like, while open timestamps doesn't do this right now, without changing the client side, like without changing the proof format, it can do clever tricks to embed hashes in ordinary transactions in a way where the hash isn't actually in the transaction, right? Because timestamping is not about putting something in the chain. It's about making the chain commit to data. And commit is a mathematical term that's basically hashing, but not quite. Well, commitments can be done through hashes, so the data itself is not actually anywhere near there. Not to mention, of course, open timestamp itself behind the hood, you know, it's got Merkle trees and Merkle trees and Merkle trees. So your data, when you timestamp it, comes nowhere near an open timestamp server, let alone a blockchain.
So I know, like, you're not a fan, really, of putting JPEGs on Bitcoin.
I'm agnostic about that.
Yeah, like, do you feel any...
I think we have to accept it's going to be feasible, and there's not much we can do about it. Like, unless we're willing to...
you want to fix the filters?
Yeah, that's stupid. I mean, my fork, Libra Relay, deliberately... expands the filters slightly, and the one notable way where they're kind of paternalistic, which is the op return limit. You know, having this 80 byte op return limit thing is just laughable when people are in standard transactions putting like 100K JPEGs. So I submitted a pull request to Bitcoin Core to remove the op return limit, and that got rejected for silly reasons. So that's the one thing Libra Relay really does.
Who rejected you?
Well, a bunch of people rejected me, but I forget who actually closed it, but it might be Nate Chow, but...
isn't the actual consensus maximum for OpReturn, is it 1 megabyte?
Well, it is 1 megabyte, well, technically slightly less than 1 megabyte, because it is not in witness space, right?
Because it's in the original block
space.
Yes,
because it's in script. It's in a script pub key, not a witness.
So...
And I got to point out, like, op return is a very expensive way to put data in the Bitcoin blockchain. Like, nobody actually uses it other than a few niche things.
You know, there's runes now.
Well, I mean, like I say, other than a few relatively niche things, open timestamps is an example. And the reason why it does that is because it makes the open timestamps proof smaller because it doesn't have to go through the Coinbase to prove it.
One of the things Casey Rodebar come up with runes, he's joked about is, well, are we going to, you know, we've seen people make a JPEG close to 4 megabytes.
Yeah.
His joke is, well, are we going to see the first 1 megabyte runes transaction?
Hey, someone can do it if they want to. Libra Relay will help.
So you relay transact op returns.
Yeah, Libra Relay is Bitcoin Core minus the op return limits. So there's no limit on the size of data in op return, and there's also no limit on how many you could put in transaction. And then it has code that makes sure it's paired with other Libra Relay instances, so that it advertises a service bit, the Libra Relay service bit, and make sure you're connected to at least 4 of those peers. It also advertises the full RBF service bit, because I did all that same thing with full RBF nodes. And Libra Relay also, of course, has full RBF enabled by default. And then the final thing it does, which I think is the one thing that's kind of technically interesting, is it does replace by fee rate, which is unrelated to any of these discussions, but basically means rather than just replacing a transaction if it pays more in total fees, it can also replace transaction if it pays more in fee rate, which happens to solve transaction pinning attacks, which affects Lightning. Now, I don't think the Ordinals people care about any of that, but I was going to go do Libra Relay because someone paid me to do it. I figured, well, screw that. I'm going to also do this other thing I want and experiment with it.
Need ASIC help? Check out Bitamine, one of Bitmain's certified repair shops located in Washington State with satellite offices in Colorado, Oklahoma, and Texas. PSUs, hashboards, immersion setups, in and out of warranty repair, Bitamine has you covered. Want to train your technicians? Bring Bitamine to your site for hands-on training in the art of ASIC repair, complete with Bitmain AMTC certification. Contact Bitamine today at dan@vmasic.com. Again, that's dan@vmasic.com. When you think of ASIC repair, think Bitamine.
Let's go to MEV. We kind of dance around a little bit with ordinals and fee rate, stuff like that. What did you think about Matt's piece, assuming you read it?
I read the MEV thing. Because he had two things recently, right?
He did.
Yeah.
He had the
I think I read the MEV one.
Yeah.
Or as he would say, Meevil.
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 We should make an ordinals collection called Meevil, and it'd be like little plushies.
Yeah.
Like little
Meevil plushies.
We'll give you one. We'll give you an honorary one.
And they only count if they're submitted out of band.
Yeah. You can only buy them by transferring an on-chain transaction that was submitted out of band.
Yeah.
It has to have two. Yeah. Actually, no. It has to have not just like 2 op returns in it, but also a script pub key that doesn't fit the standard formats, which Libra Relay will not relay.
And you create a beyond max transaction depth.
Yeah.
Julian, if you're listening to this, please help us out.
No, I think Marathon said they're not going to do out of band. So
okay, well that's lame.
No, I'll figure.
What did you? It's okay. They're not sponsoring the podcast, so.
Yeah.
Maybe one day. Okay, so tell us a little bit what you thought about that blog post, because we are of the opposite opinion on what he came to, but he's also, you know, pretty smart.
I forget off the top of head what his conclusion was, but I know what my conclusion is over MEV.
I'll take that one,
which
too.
Which is it's a very dangerous thing, and we should design protocols and standards and so on that the opportunities for MEV are as limited as possible. Libra Relay is one of those things. You know, one of the reasons why I made Libra Relay is I want to say, hey, you know, Bitcoin Core, if you try to go filter stuff, it's completely useless, because filtering invites a form of MEV where people just broadcast stuff out of band. Well, if they can run Libra Relay, that cuts down on that particular type of MEV.
Can you walk that out a little bit more for listeners?
Well, I mean, let's suppose, for op return, period. Yeah. Let's suppose you want an op return that's really big. Without Libra Relay, your options are to go to a miner and probably pay them some extra to convince them to go mine your weird op return thing. With Libra Relay, you can just download a copy of Libra Relay and run it. I mean, technically compile a copy of Libra Relay and run it. Libra Relay will figure out how to peer to other Libra Relay people, and there are Libra Relay nodes that are connected to F2 pool. So I hear. Maybe it's other pools as well. I think Mara. Mara said, there were two. I haven't actually followed on chain, but they told me they did. So yeah, Mara or F2 pool, they'll happily mine it. And now you are paying a fee with a marketplace rather than some special deal. Yeah. Any miner who wants to do this could just run Libra Relay. And the moment op return becomes notable in terms of fee revenue, they will. Just like with full RBF, they all ran full RBF the moment it became notable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. So Matt's piece, one of the conclusions was that he didn't think that MEV mattered as much as people were letting it on to be. And it came down a lot to definitions.
I don't think he's wrong there, yeah. But I think, you know, MEV doesn't matter as much as people are worried about because we're pretty good at engineering it away.
Yeah, and that was a conclusion here. Yeah. I don't know if you went to the OpCat panel. Well, it wasn't really. It was a Covenants panel, but it became an OpCat panel by the end of it.
I forget.
And they talked about MEV and how it's a design system.
I'll give you an interesting example, actually, which is, so all these full RBF transactions or full RBF replacements that are happening are actually an example of what would have been MEV. Because you've got these, you know, inscription, ordinals, whatever guys doing these weird bidding systems where, long story short, if your bid wasn't market priced, basically I can replace your bid with my own transaction, get closer to market value. But how do I do that? Well, I pay a higher fee. And as long as there are two people optimizing this, they will wind up paying pretty much all the value in excess of what the fee should be to the miners because they compete with each other. So full RBF actually prevents that type of MEV.
But what we're seeing right now is that what is a market inefficiency turns into like real revenue to miners.
In certain types of MEV. That happens to be a nice example where that works. Other types, it doesn't work. One example of MEV, which fortunately not too important, is just making really big transactions. Because due to how the mempool code works, it isn't really feasible to just allow like near full block size transactions be broadcast because it screws with it screws with a few things, but one of them is like it screws with the block packing algorithm. So without doing better block packing algorithm, you're not going to make as much money generally if you increase the maximum transaction limit.
So that's why the core standard relay size is what, 300 kilobytes, 250,
400? 400,000 weight units,
yeah.
Which is basically 1/10 of a block. And like a way to think about this is if you do the really dumb packing of transactions into a block where you just go highest fee rate to lowest, the amount that you could be incorrect compared to a much more clever packing algorithm is related to the size of the biggest possible transaction. So basically, the whole, like a kind of way to describe it, sort of the hole you could leave in how many fees you could get is basically that. And if it's a tenth, that's the numbers I think work out to be like 5%. And 5%, who cares?
This may be the dumbest thing. Maybe everybody else has come up with ideas, but like Libre Relay functions almost to ameliorate the existing core relay
That's kind of true, but the catch with that statement is, contrary to what Luke Jr. would go tell you, core actually doesn't filter very much.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, like the filters core has, nearly all of them are for very solid, arguable technical reasons that there isn't a good reason to change that. An example is like core will not relay transactions with non-standard version numbers. Well, what are non-standard version numbers? That's actually, you know, that's really the space we leave for future upgrades to Bitcoin. So if you're a miner and aren't paying attention to your setup and you allow non-standard version numbers in, you could easily wind up mining invalid blocks on the next soft fork. Well, I think one of our design requirements is we want people to be able to run miners without looking at them and without touching them for years. Like, I know there are a small number of miners who still run P2 pool with ancient, ancient setups dating back to when P2 pool still worked. And occasionally they find blocks and those blocks are valid, even though they're like, I don't know, two soft forks behind or something because of the standardness rules. They only allow in what's valid. And, you know, those guys don't make as much money as they could, but their systems still work and don't create invalid blocks. And that's important. The other thing too is like, when it comes to things like version numbers, the actual commercial demand for doing non-standard version numbers is so small. It doesn't really matter.
You told me that you think there's maybe a few dozen people running Libre, and that alone is able to get sufficient transaction inclusion right now, it seems. Is there a threshold here? Like, how many people would you like to see running Libre Relay?
Enough that replaced by fee rate goes and works and maybe gets adopted by Bitcoin Core, but not enough they have to start answering support requests.
Yeah.
Libre Relay is a political project. You know, it's not like Bitcoin Knots and that, oh, I want everyone to go run it. It's like, oh man, if people start actually using this for a lot, I'm in trouble because I might have to start maintaining it properly. Currently, it doesn't even have a readme. Like the difference
is Knots doesn't or Libre Relay?
Libre Relay.
Okay.
I haven't actually bothered to make a readme. All it is just a branch on my GitHub. And the branch is signed, by the way, just to be clear. You can check the PHP signature so you know it's coming from me. But like, there's really not much to it. I don't have binaries or anything. And it's just the bare minimum necessary to kind of make the point. Now, with replaced by fee rate, I think it would be very interesting if some miners adopted Libre Relay so you could actually see replaced by fee rate work. And, you know, that would get us on a path where probably Bitcoin Core would adopt it too eventually. But the bare minimum necessary to do that is really just convince Marathon or Luxor or whoever else, please just run like that little bit of code. I can help you if you want.
Okay, as we're coming up on the end here, what are some things you'd like to see miners start to do proactively? And again, I'm going back to that Matt Corello piece where he was like imploring people to look at SV2. Yeah. He's imploring miners to care more about block template construction.
Stratum V2 is interesting. I'm not maybe as excited about it as some people are, but we are much better if it exists, since at least some people start using it. And also people start using it in a way where like we figure out how economically viable certain parts of it are. And a good example of this is like, you know, one answer could be to tell people, oh, you know, just go mine on Ocean. But the fact is, variants cost money. Like it or not, there are good reasons to mine on big pools if you have big operations, which have big bills. So there's a reason why miners do what they do. And I would like to see, for instance, like a new version of P2 pool out that fixes the issues P2 pool had. And there are people who have very interesting ideas about this, and they can probably, you know, actually do this. But that isn't necessarily like something like your average guy with hashing power has to worry about directly, unless they want to, you know, do some donations and fund some development effort. But honestly, I'd say like the most concrete thing they could possibly do is probably just point some of their hash power at one of these smaller pools, just to make sure that if something goes wrong, they know how to point all their hash power at it.
Gotcha. Okay. What about OpCat, OpCTV, anything else? That was a big conversation topic here. Like everything just somehow turned into an OpCat conversation.
This is a conference full of developers. Of course, new opcodes will be a big conversation.
Developers
love opcodes.
And I sent a text.
I mean, I just gave a talk on my OpExpire proposal to like three people.
Yeah. It's thoroughly developer conference. I sent in a message to a deep miner chat I'm in yesterday. I was like, does anyone know about OpCat and what do you think? And I got one text back because I don't think anyone else knew what OpCat was. And it was a guy, big OG miner. And he goes, I don't care about OpCat. I don't want it to hear about it until BIP9 happens. And that's all that happened. What do you think about miners in a next upgrade with like a speedy trial or an opcode or something like that? Where do they place into this ecosystem?
I mean, for starters, we have to come up with an upgrade that's reasonable. And I'd say the upgrade that makes the most sense to do in the near term is probably actually the like consensus cleanup stuff. Because there's a whole bunch of stuff we have around Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin protocol that's kind of screwy. One good example being, well, what is one of the reasons why we have lock filters or, you know, mempool filters? Well, it's because version zero scripting has a lot of issues with it that could turn in straight up DOS attacks. You know, you can construct blocks, which will take minutes to validate. And if a miner manages to do this, for most miners, they're screwed because, you know, they're probably get orphaned out. Equally, for certain miners who are really big, they could also screw other miners. And we're much better off if these problems just don't exist. There's also the Time Warp attack, which really should be fixed. Like, it's kind of a hypothetical attack, but it's not implausible it gets attacked. And it would just screw up Bitcoin in so many ways. It's far better to just fix it.
I didn't know there was a solution to the Time Warp attack.
You know, I could not
explain it
so
to the audience.
Yeah.
The Time Warp attack is what it really comes down to. It's like an off by one error in how difficulty is calculated. And because of this error, basically you can drive drive difficulty down and then create far more blocks than you should be able to create. And it screws up everything. I mean, you can get into a place where Bitcoin's very insecure. It's a mess. And apparently it can be fixed with a soft fork that soft forks out the specific way that you drive difficulty down. Off the top of my head, I could tell you how the hell that works. It's one of these attacks which is like, all right, whoever figured this out is pretty smart. It was probably Greg Maxwell or something. But, you know, it's an ugly attack. You might as well go fix it. And once you fix it, well, you just don't have to worry about the silliness, and it's just one less thing to, you know. And this is why I'd say, like, these kinds of fixes, in theory, they should be pretty uncontroversial fixes. Like version zero scripting, we're confident we don't need to have all these edge cases that can create DOS attacks. Like, it's okay to fix this stuff.
So there's some basic core cleanup that you think would be very low lift comparatively to demonstrate what a software
like. It's low risk precisely because it's all reducing risk, and hopefully it would be uncontroversial. Now, annoyingly, like, you know, the Time Warp attack is an example. Well, there is some crazy proposals people have had to leverage the Time Warp attack to do certain other things. But honestly, I think like some of those proposals, it's kind of like if, you know, you noticed your toaster happened to be able to go and turn your furnace on and off. And like when your furnace turns on and off, that also like controls the temperature of your fridge. You know, and if your fridge happens to be behind a glass wall, you know, it might be easier to use this convoluted scheme to go make sure your ice cream doesn't melt.
Yeah.
Like, it, you know, that makes total sense, right? Like, you could do this other thing by just breaking down the glass wall and rebuilding it later to go and fix the temperature sensor in your fridge. But, you know, if you really don't want to break the glass wall, well, why don't we just keep on doing the toaster, furnace, like, whatever thing?
Sounds right? Like you just described the Bitcoin Core consensus process. And how we even describe some of the problems or the discussions on the upgrade. People get hung up on the particular brand of the furnace.
Well, fortunately, in this case, I think I'm describing crazy people who don't have that much influence on Bitcoin development. But I can guarantee you, like, if someone actually proposed a concrete soft fork, fixed Time Warp, some of these people are going to come out of the woodwork and complain that their pet projects are getting eliminated. It's like, dude, your stuff is so convoluted, no one would ever actually want to implement that. Nuts. Do something simpler.
Okay, as we wrap up, last question for you. Do you think we get something in the next 2 years for an opcode?
For an opcode?
Or a soft fork, I should say.
For an opcode, I think no. For a soft fork, maybe.
Okay.
But I would not bet in favor of this happening within 2 years.
Okay.
I think it would be a bit longer than that.
Okay.
I mean, check lock time verify, which was very boring and uncontroversial. It was like a 4-year project.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin was a lot smaller then.
Yeah. Yeah. Burnout from that one. Okay. Peter Todd, thank you so much for joining the Mining Pod. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.